This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we learn about International Music Camp. But we are going to start today with the author Danielle Lincoln Hanna. She is the author of the Mailboat Suspense series, set in Wisconsin, and she now lives in Montana, but she is from North Dakota. And I gather, Danielle, first of all, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That North Dakota really was important to you when you first were starting writing. And I'm thinking about a book called The Shift in the Wind. So let's talk about what it is about North Dakota that really informs your writing style.
You know, I think, gosh, there is so much I love about my home state. And it was the spot where I, you know, first started writing just as a little kid. And I think it's a great environment for that, because right now I'm living in Western Montana. I'm living in the mountains, and this has what I call obvious beauty. Like, you show up here, people's jaws drop. Of course it's beautiful here. But then I tell people I'm from North Dakota, and they say, oh, I've driven through. You know? And they have no idea what's beautiful about the state. It has what I call beauty that is not obvious. You have to slow down. You have to stop. You have to look around you. You have to appreciate the things that are there.
I think
as a writer, that can really just help you tune your observation skills and see the beauty around you and what makes something different or unique or worth writing about.
Well, the new book in the series, this is the fourth book. It's called The Shift in the Wind. It's coming out August 1st. And I got to say, as someone who works in public media, I was just tickled to hear that this is the inspiration for the entire Mailboat series is from a PBS show.
It was. This was back when I was living in North Dakota, not that long ago. And I was watching public television, and in North Dakota, I don't know if this is still true, but at the time we were getting some programming from Minnesota, which was also getting some programming from Wisconsin. And they were playing a show called, yeah, it's kind of great. It's nice because you get to know like your entire region that way. So I definitely love that. There was this one program called Outdoor Wisconsin, and they re-aired an episode they had done about the Lake Geneva Mailboat. This boat that delivers the mail house to house around this lake in southeast Wisconsin. And they hire teens and college kids who have to jump off the boat to put the mail in the boxes, which are located on the piers. And the boat is so big, it never stops. So they have to turn around, run back, get back on that boat before it's gone. And if they don't time it quite right, they could end up in the lake.
Yeah. And with your mail, man.
Most likely your outgoing mail, that tends to be where the mistakes happen.
Well, yeah. And this is your main character, Bailey's. This is kind of her dream, is to be one of these fleet-footed kids.
It is. Yeah. And I've got both the first book in the series and a prequel. The prequel tells the story of how she became a mail jumper. And the first book in the series, called The End of the Pier, starts a very intriguing mystery with roots that go way back into the history of the town and dark doings. So
well, give us a little bit more of a teaser than that. How do you describe the Mailboat series?
How do I describe the Mailboat series? I usually tell people it is the story of a teenage girl named Bailey. She is in foster care. The only thing she wants is to finally get a family of her own. And instead she finds a body at the end of somebody's pier, and thus starts the mystery.
Yeah. Thanks, universe. That's not what I meant.
That's not what she asked for.
Well, I was intrigued to find on your website, DanielleLincolnHanna.com, and that's Hanna, H-A-N-N-A, that in addition to, as you would expect on an author's website, there's stuff about your book, there's stuff about book signings and events and book readings and what have you, but you also have blog posts about the foster care system that ostensibly started out as research to kind of flesh out Bailey's character, but really has turned into a passion for you.
Yeah. You know, like I let my characters tell me who they are. The minute I try to tell them who they are, they quit talking to me and nothing happens.
Are they teenagers?
Yeah, they are. Very moody teenagers. And this character introduced herself to me and explained that, like, the person who is her quote-unquote dad isn't actually her dad. And I was like, oh, like, your stepdad. She said, no, actually, I'm in foster care. And I said, you can't do that. I don't know anything about foster care. But, you know, she put her foot down. So I said, okay, I guess I'm going to go learn about foster care. And, gosh, my boyfriend will tell you that anytime I decide to go and kind of brush up what I know about the foster care system, I will then proceed to go spend days tromping around our apartment, blowing steam, feeling genuinely kind of miserable. Yeah. Because on the one hand, it is full of people who want so much to do good for children who have been in very poor circumstances, who need a better shot at life, who just need to break away from a bad situation and maybe just let their family of origin figure things out, or, you know, maybe start over with a new family. But at the same time, the foster care system is frankly so overwhelmed that there ends up being a lot of things slipping under the radar that should not be happening. And if you just go online and Google foster care story, your heart will break over and over and over, because by and large, the stories you hear are stories of kids who are telling you of abuse that happened to them in foster care, in the system that was supposed to save them. And it is so heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even the history, the early days of the foster care, and you talk about this on your website, this idea of orphan trains, where we loaded up entire trains full of kids and just brought them to somewhere else. And it was forced labor. It was free labor. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with taking care of the child at all.
Not exactly, no. Yeah, they had a problem in the big cities back east. There were a lot of homeless children, you know, the street urchins out on the city streets, known to take care of them. People were worried they were going to turn into thieves and prostitutes and every nasty thing. And they were worried, I think, mostly about the safety of their own streets and probably about their own interests. I'm sure there were people involved who were genuinely concerned about the kids. But the solution became, they need labor out west. Let's put the children on trains. Let's send them out west. They would stop at a town. They would line the kids up on the train platform. You hear stories of them being just lined up from tallest to shortest. Ugh. And the local citizens would come by and see just how sturdy the child was, and oftentimes take them based on that. You know, what kind of labor can we get out of this child? We need help on our farms. And sometimes that worked out great for the kids. Sometimes they turned out in a really good family. But again, you also hear stories of people saying, I was not treated well. I was a slave. This was not a new family for me. Mm-hmm. I was here to work.
You mentioned this, that every time you do research on the foster care system to help advance your series, you end up getting very angry. You blog about this as well. And that's uh-huh. so common with creatives, with writers, with musicians who paint and painters, you know, people who have the feels, right? Uh-huh. But then there is this concept of sympathy does not equal action. So I'm wondering, is this process of writing a more accurate picture of what it's like to be in foster care, is that part of just trying to do whatever you can to help?
I think so. You know, when I listen to people who are, you know, working in the foster care system and recognizing that there are things that need to change, one of the things they ask for repeatedly is, we just need more awareness. We need more people to know that there are children in need. One of the things they ask for is more foster families, you know, more people willing to sign up. Because frankly, if they had more options of homes to send children to, they would have more options to suss out the ones that are not good homes. Sometimes mm-hmm. a not a good home remains with a license out of desperation, because where else is the child going to go? So, yeah, you know, I started out just writing a character as she was presenting herself to me. And it's definitely been an exploration of, okay, I have this information now. What is my role? What am I supposed to do with it? And I'm like, mm-hmm. well, I have a platform. And they're saying they need awareness. So I can easily fill that niche right there.
Book 4, The Shift in the Wind, comes out in August 1st, in fact. And Danielle, I'm wondering also about Detective Monica Steele. And right away, we have a female author and a female protagonist and a female heroine. Was that just happenstance of, okay, you're a woman, it's not as hard to write from a female perspective? Or were you very intentional about wanting female agency in your books?
You know, I think there was definitely a degree of wanting some female agency. When it came to Detective Monica Steele's character, I knew I wanted, like, Bailey's role in the story is very much, there's a lot of things happening around her and to her, and she's being affected by it all. And she's just trying to figure out how you survive, not only in foster care, but with, like, murders happening and stuff. so that's mostly Bailey's role. And I definitely wanted someone to spearhead, like, the investigation. Like, we got to figure out who's doing this. We got to bring this person to justice and make these things end. So I was like, okay, I want to write a police detective. And I asked myself, is it going to be male or female? And I went with female because it is a little more badass. It does have that female agency. And I thought it would be a lot of fun. And I also started picturing a male patrol officer. And they started having a lot of sparks flying. Turned out they are each other's ex and ended up at the same department together and did not know. So that's a lot of fun to write, honestly. And it's also fun writing, you know, just this really go-get-em female detective as well.
And then you have this book coach, Jacqueline. Now, yes. She's not a character in the book. She's a real person in your real life. What is a book coach?
So a book coach, this became an absolute necessity for me during the pandemic. I normally go to a little coffee shop to get my writing done. I'm very location centric. This spot is for this activity. That spot is for that activity. So my coffee shop is for my writing. During the pandemic, that was not easily had. And my writing decidedly suffered. My writing habit, it was just so hard to get any words done every day. So I went in search of a book coach. And this is someone who basically holds your hand and makes sure that the words are getting written. It was her job every day to meet me via Zoom and be like, okay, where's your headspace? What are you trying to do today? Mm-hmm. And I would explain, here's what I want to do. Here's how I'm feeling. And, you know, she'd try to help me get into that proper headspace to try to get things done. And then she would text me every hour. Or was it every half hour? I think it was every half hour. And she would say, are you writing?
Wow.
So yes, huge thanks to Jacqueline. Also, she ended up having a personal emergency partway through and ended up passing me on to a friend of hers named Tiffany. So thanks to Jacqueline and Tiffany, I got Mailboat 4 done.
You know, when I was first trying to cultivate a minimalist wardrobe, I got to the point with the closet purges where I would just ask my friend or my sister to just come and sit at the house with me. I'm like, you don't actually need to do any of the work, but I need you to sit here and make sure that I'm doing the work.
Yeah, exactly.
And also to manage expectations. Is there some of that in the role of a book coach?
Oh, I think so. I'm very guilty of expecting way too much out of myself, way more than I can actually get done in a day. And then sometimes I beat myself up afterwards because I didn't accomplish it all. And one of the things I loved about Jacqueline, she would ask me, okay, how many chapters are you trying to do? And I would say, I'm trying to do this one, this one, this one. And she would say, and how much time do you think chapter 23 is going to take? And I was like, oh, well, I never thought of it that way. And I would say, you know, come to think of it, I think I could do chapter 3 in an hour. Okay. And she'd write that down. And, you know, and it just helped keep expectations more realistic. And sometimes just doing that exercise, I'd realize, oh, you know, in my head, I was going to do like 5 chapters today. And when it's on paper, I see maybe 3, maybe 2, maybe 1 is more realistic for my workload tonight.
Well, it's that classic left brain, right brain thing. You can be wildly creative and come up with ideas out of nowhere, or you can be very analytical and, you know, deadline oriented. And it's very hard to have both.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My left and my right brains don't actually like each other.
Can you talk about what it is like being an independent author?
Yeah, I would describe it as an adventure the whole way. So there's nowadays we have our options between traditional publishing and self-publishing. Traditional being, you know, you probably get yourself an agent who represents you to a book publisher. In self-publishing, you don't have to, basically, you don't have to ask anyone's permission. You can just go and do it with the marvels of the internet. You can upload your book on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and honestly quite a few other platforms. You can create your own ebooks, paperbacks, hardbacks, audiobooks. There's not a lot that's off limits to yourself as a self-publisher. The only difference being you definitely have to be self-motivated.
Or get a coach
yeah. And the other difference being if you have your agent and your publisher, there are a lot more people to pay.
Mm.
When you're self-publishing, all the expenses are your own. But at the end of the day, the pay is yours. So I decided to go with self-publishing, and I am honestly quite happy with my decision.
Who edits your books?
Oh, so I always tell people, do as I say and not as I do.
Let me make that mistake for you. That's the blog I would start if I had a coach
that. I would actually write it as The Joys of Being OCD.
Okay. Solid. You're hired as my house cleaner, by the way.
You're welcome. So I've not been officially diagnosed with OCD, but it's pretty obvious. So I push myself to the utmost to make a very solid story and a very clean copy. So I do still have editors, but in a slightly different sense. I have got, first of all, my expert advisors. These are people who are medical professionals, law enforcement. Who else do I have? I have a therapist on my team who reads my stuff. That is pretty awesome. And they are the very first people who get to read the full manuscript. And they will let me know basically what don't fly. This is not how we do this. This is not how we'd expect that to happen. I consider that my content edit because that's the kind of stuff that could cause me to have to rewrite entire chapters and be like, oh, okay, it's not going to work that way. We have to rethink this completely. So those are my first level of editors. The next is my my early reader team. And this is a group of people who are, you know, they might actually have some professional expertise. Maybe they are retired English teacher, or maybe they are actually an active like proofreader or editor. But I managed to get them all for free for the joy of it, which is kind of amazing. I just made a practice of asking people, are you willing to read my manuscript? You get to read it early. You get to read it for free. You have my eternal thanks and gratitude. And I've actually got 50 people on my early reader team, most of whom have some kind of professional experience, and they do my proofreading for me. So
that is a big team. Yeah,
it is a very big team. That is the power of asking, just continuing to ask people.
Right.
And every time I have a new book out, I message my newsletter and I say, hey, I'm looking for more people for my early reader team. Write me back. Let me know what experience you have. And if I like it, you can join.
Well, what about just someone who is in the key demographic of who your books are aimed at? Is that qualification enough?
Not usually for my early reader team, but I have just this year launched my street team.
Oh.
And because I was having people who were maybe a little disappointed that maybe their prior experience didn't qualify them for basically my editing team.
Okay.
And I was like, you know, I would love to have people who are just helping me hype the book. And of course, if they see anything they want me to change, they're welcome to bring it up. So I now have my street team. Which again, I send a note out to my newsletter. I say, hey, do you want to join the street team? And I was hoping to get like a dozen people for this first time having a street team, and I ended up with 40. So I think I'm doing all right.
You can find out more about that at DanielleLincolnHannah.com. Danielle, what's with this buy me a coffee on your website?
Oh, that is something, which is honestly pretty delightful. Like some of my, You end up with super fans after a while. You end up with people who just want to support what you're doing because they love it so much. And so I created, and I have a web store on my website. People can buy autographed books. They can actually buy ebooks via my website, which is the best way to support me because, again, I'm not splitting royalties that much. And I made this option for buy me a coffee because some people just, it's like throwing a tip at me basically. And they're like, they know that I'm at my coffee shop writing. They're like, I want to be part of the process. I want to buy her latte tonight, you know? So I made that an option and people do use it and it touches me every time.
Are you able to do this as your full-time, can still pay all the bills?
This is my full-time job and I feel so, so lucky.
Has Bailey revealed to you yet how many more books she wants to be in?
Yes, more or less. So I know how the storyline goes. I am famously bad at judging how many books it will take to to tell that story. Again, I always think it's going to be less than what it turns out to be. So I, at the moment, based on my current outlines, I think there's going to be about 8 books in the entire series, and we are on book 4 right now, so we are about halfway through.
Well, a classic, you know, trope for writers is write what you know, and you're talking about being a foster kid who has overcome violence and trauma and how that impacts survivorship. You sound mm-hmm. quite happy. Are you writing what you know?
Yes. I tell people ask me all the time, they look at me and they say, are you Bailey? And I tell them, yes. I tell them our experiences were not identical, but they had enough similarities that we were sort of affected in very similar ways. So, you know, for her exact experiences in foster care, I've had to research that. Mm-hmm. But that sense of like how you feel being an abused child, that is coming a lot more from personal experiences. I was never physically abused. I was never sexually abused, but I was psychologically and emotionally abused mm-hmm. quite a bit. And in my opinion, the psychological and emotional abuse are the foundation to any kind of abuse. So I do feel like I am writing from a lot of personal experience there.
How much of the writing process is therapy?
Oh, all of it. I did go to therapy for a few years. I had an excellent, excellent therapist in Bismarck. And there were some sessions. I was working on this series of books, and there were some sessions where she would not ask me questions about me. She would ask me questions about my characters.
Oh, that's genius.
Because we found, yeah, she would ask me questions about my characters because it was so obvious that my books are a safe place to put the emotions. You know, you keep emotions bottled up and it's going to do damage and it's mm-hmm. going to keep doing damage until you figure out what to do with it. And for me, it was a book is a very safe place to keep those emotions. And in fact, to get them to actually do some good, you know, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that if people read my series, they can start to recognize what abuse looks like, you know, whether they are Bailey, whether they're that person that's trapped in abuse and maybe not realizing it, mm-hmm. or if they are someone who knows someone, because it can be very, very hard to identify abuse from the outside. You know, when I started telling people about what had happened, I had so many people who would look at me with like tears in their eyes and tell me, I'm so sorry. If I had known, I would have done something. And I was like, but you didn't know. And at the end of the day, there wasn't a lot you could have done because I needed to be the one who said, no, I'm done with this, and moved on.
Danielle Lincoln Hanna is the author of the Mailboat Suspense series. Book 4, The Shift in the Wind, comes out on August 1st. And you can find out more at DanielleLincolnHanna.com. Danielle, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a real pleasure.
Still to come on Main Street, International Music Camp adapts to the pandemic. But now, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Public Service Commission has approved a pipeline project to carry carbon dioxide from the Great Plains Synfuels plant to underground storage nearby. The project consists of 2.9 miles of 9-inch diameter pipe plus 3.9 miles of 6-inch diameter pipe.
This is really, I think, taking North Dakota into the whole world of capturing and storing carbon dioxide from our energy production in North Dakota in our own state.
PSC Chairman Julie Fedorchuk says she thinks this project has huge potential.
We can see a pathway for our state becoming kind of a leader in this area. The whole challenge of capturing our carbon dioxide globally and reducing those emissions, it just makes so much sense to me that the quickest way to do that and to reduce our global emissions is to capture it off of existing sources and store it.
Great Plains' parent company, Basin Electric Power Cooperative, plans to start construction on the $25 million project in September with an in-service date of August 2022. Fedorchak says this is one step, the other being the siting of injection wells. MDU will be building an extension from the WBI natural gas pipeline to Wahpeton. This increase will increase the supply of natural gas to that city. Right now, Wahpeton-Breckenridge is served by Great Plains Natural Gas, an MDU subsidiary, through a pipeline on the Minnesota side. Here's MDU spokesman Mark Hansen.
So this brings a supply down off WBI's pipeline that will give us additional volumes that will be able to allow a business to expand or bring in new business. So it's exciting for what we can bring to Wahpeton there, and it's been a long kind of haul in the making to make this happen.
Hansen says the 60-mile pipeline extension from Mapleton to Wahpeton will also bring natural gas to Kindred. He says the plan is to start construction on the $60 million project in early 2024 and have it finished by later that year. And Grand Forks leaders will continue to hold discussions with SeaQuest officials in an effort to bring the Interactive Animal Ecosystem Aquarium to town. The proposed site for the 17,000-square-foot facility would be in the former Kmart building at the Grand Cities Mall. In order to make the move, SeaQuest is seeking some financial assistance. City Administrator Todd Phelan says local investment could be up to $1 million.
So as we've gone along, similar to the Columbia Mall, you know, everyone's looking at opportunities to add traffic to their sites. And as we've gone on and discussed, people want to go to experiences.
Company CEO Vince Covino says he believes SeaQuest would quickly become the number one destination in Grand Forks, attracting 300,000 visitors per year. Covino says his company is Amazon-proofing economies because it's an experience you can't buy online. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Maria Rana tells us what it was like growing up in a multicultural family in Peru.
My mother was the only American I knew.
Linda Leeming left the hills of Tennessee for the Himalayas and found a new life for herself in Bhutan.
I like myself better in Bhutan.
And sampled the tapas in Barcelona.
When I say this to the people, they say, oh, but anchovies.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The International Music Camp at the Peace Garden has been around for more than 60 years. A lot of people have many fond memories, and it can sometimes change the course of their lives. For some students, the camp is not their first time to be surrounded by others who put a high value on art. But the pandemic was extra tough on the International Music Camp. Not only worries about contagion, but the closing of the U.S.-Canada border made their camp unusable. So this summer, they went on the road. Director of Radio Bill Thomas caught up with them at North Dakota State University.
If you're trying to find the traveling version of the International Music Camp, well, you just prowl the halls and listen, coming out from the doors of the practice rooms. French horn. Trombones. And the clarinets.
What? Ready?
Get to the middle of it and you find...
I'm Jason Rigg. I'm the guest conductor of the IMC on the Road in Fargo, originally from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
So the International Music Camp is normally done at the Peace Gardens, and it's a great tradition, and I've talked to so many North Dakotans who have great memories of going there, but this year it's not there, right?
Correct. The pandemic is such that both of the countries, the United States and Canada, needed to close that border, and so that kind of precluded all of the camp activities from happening. We've received some good news recently where Canada is deciding to open up the border here within the next few weeks. And so I think if you've got your passport and your vaccination card, that you'll get you where you need to be. So fingers crossed that it'll all happen at camp and on the actual campus next summer, which is what we all hope that can happen. But it's been really great this year just to, you know, hit different spots in the road. And
yeah, well, so explain the alternative that you worked out.
Well, so this year I got a phone call from Tim and Christine Bauman, the camp directors, and they said, we want to, you know, take this on the road and do it in a smaller, you know, some smaller venues and that kind of thing. And I thought it was a wonderful idea. We weren't able to do anything last summer with the pandemic still really in full stride. So this was just a great plan to be able to get out into the communities and instead of having everyone come to camp, bring the camp to everyone. We did a camp in Minot a couple of weeks ago that really worked well. And we're at the halfway point basically of this one in Fargo. And next week we'll be in Bismarck. Doing the same thing. So it's been a great way to just get the music camp back in everyone's brains again, that's a, you know, a thing that exists and a great opportunity for kids to take advantage of in the summertime. The great thing that's happening here, though, is and with all the sites for the on the road, is that there are section coaches. That right now kids are actually in sectionals working on their music with a trained pro in that specific instrument. And we'll get together and have a full rehearsal here and kind of put together everything that they have been working on. But that really makes the difference for them to get some individualized help. And really the secret of this whole thing that's making it work is that these same musicians are playing side by side next to the campers. So they're able to model, you know, the appropriate posture and embouchure and sound and help with that pesky F sharp if the kid missed it or, you know, whatever. And there's just so much learning at such a fast pace that's happening here. It's really, really great to see. Just the difference from yesterday when we were sight reading to today has been just incredible. So
now in a typical music camp session, do the kids come for how long?
Usually at music camp, at the International Music Camp, it's a week long. So they'll show up Sunday evening, and we sight read Monday morning, and the concert is Saturday afternoon. So we've got a full week and they're getting private lessons, they're getting a master class on their instrument, they're getting sectional time, they're learning some fundamental skills mixed in with, you know, meal times and free time and all that kind of stuff too, plus full rehearsal. And here, this is just a three-day camp. So this is our Tuesday, as it were, and they've only, like, the middle school kids are here for 3 hours from 9 until noon. And they've got basically a little sectional time at the beginning, and then we come back with full rehearsal. And so it's not the full experience with, you know, the master classes from these technicians and, you know, all the other things that the camp can offer. We're just kind of gearing it straight towards the music that they're performing. And it's really been great to see it all come together. It's usually at the camp when we sight read Monday morning, I go, "Whew, how are we going to get there on Saturday?" And it always happens. So then when they said, "Let's do this in 3 days," and I went, "How in the world is this going to happen?" And it does. It does.
Well, let me ask you about doing this kind of teaching, because some people would imagine being in a room full of middle school kids who are playing wrong notes and everything, and it would be a nightmare. But what's the good and the bad about this?
There is so much good. Maybe for me, the easiest way that I can explain it is that I feel like a kid when I'm with them. I remember being that age. I remember specifically being in middle school and and reveling in how awkward it was for all of us. And wanting to know, I guess, be able to give back to these kids that it's okay, that the awkwardness that you're experiencing is normal and that it's going to get better. And so I like to be there because it's fun to enjoy that with them and to let them know that, you know, this it does get better and things are going to improve and life won't be as awkward as it seems like it's going to be at the current moment. And I think if students can have a role model in those times, specifically with middle school and middle school band and all the stuff that comes with everybody when they're in middle school, just to have a friendly face to go, yep, it's okay. We made a couple of mistakes today, but tomorrow's going to be better and it'll be fine. That's my jam. I've always loved music. I've always loved, you know, great music. But I think the world needs teachers at that middle school level that can laugh with kids and know when to laugh and to give an encouraging word and just to let them know that, yeah, everything's going to be all right.
Now, did you go to music camp when you were a kid?
I did. I am a product of music camp. In every way, shape, and form. My mother and father and stepfather were all music teachers in North Dakota when I was growing up in the 80s, let's say. I graduated in 1993. But so I was kind of expected to play in the bands and sing in the choirs, and it didn't really mean all that much to me. I'd have been rather shooting baskets or playing football or video games or whatever it was. And there was a brass quintet called the Dallas Brass that was the artist in residence at International Music Camp. And I had seen them in concert a few times. And I'm a French horn player. And the French horn player there was just amazing. He could, in my opinion, could do no wrong on the instrument, could play so beautifully. And it happened that they were the artist in residence at the International Music Camp for one summer back in the, I think it was the very early 90s or late 80s. And that's how my mom convinced me to go to music camp. You'll be able to take a lesson with this guy and it'll be great. And so I kind of begrudgingly went to camp and it changed my life. There are people that I met that first week there at that camp that I still communicate with to this day via Facebook and, you know, everyone else. We're all spread to the four winds. But it was just such a place that took me in. I'm a tall person, and so I played a lot of basketball. And it was so just reaffirming for me that I could be an athlete and I could be a musician and all of that was going to be okay. That camp really helped me to find my voice musically, for sure. Fast forward, I went to undergrad at Minot State University and got my degree and had a teaching job ready, lined up in Stanley, North Dakota. And then I went back to that music camp to be a dean of boys for the summer. So whenever those kids are not in class, they're the dean's responsibility. Turns out the lady who is now my wife was also a dean of girls that week. And that was back in 1997. It was magical. It was just absolutely magical. I have told kids before and audiences before that everything that's really good in my life, my love of music, the love of my life, I owe it all to the International Music Camp. So when they call and say, we want you to come and do something, I will come as often as they ask me, as long as I'm able to do whatever I can to give back to this place. Because I just feel like everything great for me is a result of this place.
Well, with such a testimonial as that, we wrapped up the interview. But I still wanted to know more about future plans and the kind of, you know, institutional issues about the International Music Camp. So I went down to the lobby of Festival Concert Hall looking for Christine Bauman, who is co-director with her husband, Tim, of the International Music Camp.
We have every hope that we are going to be back up at the International Peace Garden next year with the positive news of Canadians relaxing their restrictions into Canada. We're hopeful the U.S. will do the same, which means that everybody will be able to be up at the Peace Gardens next summer. So we are feeling very hopeful and very positive about being back.
So I'm assuming you'll be restoring all kind of the other activities and everything.
Yep, we plan to, if we're able to be back up there, we plan to have our full offering of programs. So the music programs, our visual arts programs, such as drawing, painting, sculpture, our drama and musical theater programs, creative writing, music composition, kind of the whole gamut of the fine arts.
What's the best way for people to keep track of what's going on?
Probably our social media pages, so International Music Camp on Facebook and Instagram, as well as our website. Although our website, we won't have anything updated until this fall. Social media might have some hints of stuff before then.
Okay. Anything else you want to let people know about?
We're really thankful for everyone's support and encouragement the last year and a half, and we are very excited to get everybody back together up at the Peace Gardens in the future.
That was our director of radio, Bill Thomas, talking about International Music Camp's Summer on the Road with Jason Rigg, the guest conductor, and Christine Bauman, the camp's co-director. Coming up next, an excerpt from the upcoming Great American Folk Show.
Hi, educators. I'm Tim Wollensien, Education Services Manager at Prairie Public. Want to learn more about PBS Learning Media and how it can be even more valuable in the classroom? Then join me for 3 one-hour Zoom webinars happening August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. PBS Learning Media has some new and exciting interactive videos, lesson plans, and more. They're all free, and I can't wait to tell you all about them. Register for Take a New Look at PBS Learning Media at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. A Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141-member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and take a listen to this. That's the sound of an electric kiln, basically a giant oven used for making pottery. And in the case of this one, temperatures get up to 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Tom Brousseau is the host of the Great American Folk Show, which airs this Sunday on Prairie Public. And he paid a visit to Prairie Fire Pottery in Beach, North Dakota, where numerous fans blow the hot air around, making this kiln feel pleasantly like a sauna. Let's hear owner and potter Tama Smith describe how the surrounding land, the perfect small town, and her personal touch help connect artist with audience.
When I graduated from UND with my Bachelor of Fine Arts, then I went out to Michigan to work on my master's degree, and then I was out there for 7 years. And when I was there, my business was called Tama Pottery because I signed Tama on the bottom, and it was just me making and selling at art fairs around the country to see if anyone would buy my pottery. After about 7 years, I thought, you know, if I could get back to little town North Dakota. So I started looking at different towns and came across the name Prairie Fire. And it was like knowing it when you saw it or when you heard it, like a band name or something that you can fly your flag. When I looked into Prairie Fire, the lightning will start the prairie on fire, the prairie will burn, and then it'll start the coal veins on fire. So in the buttes, in the Badlands, there's coal deposits, those black stripes in the land, and those coal deposits will start burning from the prairie fire. And as the coal vein burns into the earth, then the bentonite clay above the coal vein will fire to about 1,500 degrees, 1,800 degrees, and that will produce the red scoria that you see in the Badlands, that red on top of the buttes. So that's naturally fired clay, fired from the burning coal vein. If I just went out and gathered some raw clay and took it and put it in my electric kiln and fired it to about 1,800 degrees, I would get scoria. So I could produce scoria, but I don't know if anyone would buy scoria from, you know, from a potter. When I use bentonite, I use bentonite as a glaze suspension. So the glaze is made of ground rock, silica, feldspar, whiting, dolomite, different ground rock materials. It's all ground powder fine. And when I mix that rock material with water, the rock particles will just settle out naturally. because they're heavier than the water. So the bentonite has a really fine particle. And so the bentonite will hold the glaze, the other rock materials, up in suspension. So when I stir the glaze, it'll all stay stirred and up in the water as opposed to settling out. So that bentonite, because it's such a fine particle, it will hold that rock material up in suspension in the glaze. As a potter, you want to have a small town where you can afford things. And in small town North Dakota, the cost of living and the houses and the buildings are so much less than what you would find in Bismarck or Grand Forks. I wanted to live in a small town. Well, Beach is about as far west as you can get. It's exit number one on I-94, which is the main interstate that runs across the state, and it's on the Montana border. And then the Badlands is just to the west of us, and Medora, and the National Grasslands is all around us. My county, you know, here in Beach, there's a lot of ranching and farming. The Badlands and the Buttes and the Grasslands all become so important to my influences in my work and in my pottery. There's a lot of undulation in the glazes. There's the colors of the sky and the rivulets in the buttes. I try to get that texture that happens from the rain pouring down the buttes. So when I'm in the studio creating, I'm, you know, mostly by myself when I'm creating, but I'm thinking about that this piece is going to be in somebody's life someday. So I always put three little dots, somewhere on the piece as a little hello. It's a little hello to that person who's going to have that piece in their life. And then maybe they'll use it in their life, and then maybe they'll pass it down to a child, or maybe it'll go into a garage sale, or maybe it'll end up in a secondhand store. And then the next person that finds it will have those three dots. And it's a little hello to that person who's going to have it. I really love that human connection of making and having people use the piece in their life and enjoying their morning coffee or having their special dinner or even having, you know, their everyday meal out of a prairie fire bowl. I really love that human connection that the pottery can make with people. People who like pottery usually tend to love handmade mugs. They become very special to people. But I think if you have just one piece of pottery in your life, you should have a bowl. Because bowls are so nice to eat out of and to serve with. And I really enjoy making bowls, and I love using bowls. Getting back to that three-dot thing, I had a guy email me a few weeks ago. He was in Ohio. He stopped at some gas station to fill up. He was a couple hours from home, and he saw a secondhand or a antique mall across the way, and so he thought, well, I'll just go see what's in there. And so he was wandering around, and he said he found a piece of pottery, and that he just knew he had to take it home with him. And so he Googled the name on the bottom, and turns out it was my piece. So then I told him about the three dots, because there is the next person that has that piece of pottery, and it was such a wonderful feeling to make a connection with someone who felt something when they saw your pottery.
That was Tama Smith, owner of Prairie Fire Pottery in Beach, North Dakota. You can hear Tama, along with internationally renowned singer-songwriter Paul Brady, and much more, on the Great American Folk Show this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central on Prairie Public. Dakota Datebook is next.
This summer, the Downtown Arts Market returns to the heart of Jamestown. Thursday evenings in June, July, and August from 5:30 to 8:30 in the Hanson Arts Park. Located at the corner of 1st Avenue South and 2nd Street in Jamestown. The Arts Market features regional music entertainment, artists and vendors, and arts activities for children and adults. Weekly bands and other details are available online at jamestownarts.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 28th. Modern-day people don't know much about oxen,
unless they refer to someone as a big ox or being strong as an ox. Some might know about Red River Ox Carts or maybe Babe the Blue Ox's statue in Bemidji. However, oxen were useful for farmers in North Dakota's early days as draft animals, pulling stumps, loads of hay, and the heavy work of breaking new farmland with heavy plows. Although oxen were powerful and sure-footed, they were slow when compared to horses. Nevertheless, new settlers in Dakota often used oxen rather than horses because they were half the price of a good horse. Moreover, oxen were cheaper to feed, eating only grass or hay, while horses also required oats. Plainly speaking, an ox was a steer, male calves castrated to make them tamer than a bull. Farmers trained young oxen early, just 6 months old, in order to get them accustomed to the work. This gentle training began by fastening two of them together with a small neck yoke. By pulling a cart, they learned to work as a team. Ox trainers used a stick to tap an ox on the neck to teach it to turn, along with the voice commands of G and haw. G meant turn right, haw meant turn left. When the oxen were full grown, a larger and stronger yoke was used, generally made of oak. Even without reins or mouthbits, an experienced farmer's oxen would go forward or back up by the farmer's gestures or stick waving or his well-timed grunt. If those communications failed, a light whip or ox goad, a club, brought obedience. If poverty brought tough times, the farmer could survive by fattening oxen into excellent beef. On this date in 1921, the Grand Forks Herald looked back nostalgically upon the decades when faithful oxen had plowed much of the sod of the Red River Valley. By the 1920s, horses had made oxen obsolete, being better suited for all-around farm work due to greater speed and the ability to pull newer farm machinery. Oxen had been turned out to pasture, so to speak, and were rarely seen. Still, there had been a time when oxen did the heavy pulling of the farm and did it well, receiving no coddling, no currying, and no grain rations. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Millions of people use the app Robinhood to trade stocks on their phones. Now, as the company goes public, regulators are challenging how Robinhood does business. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, business relationships, foreign investment, national security, all in a day's work if you are the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office. We visit with Drew Combs, who is recently back from a trade delegation mission to Turkey and Qatar. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.